The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to episode 568. It's a rerun, a best of episode from the first year of the podcast with Eddie Pepitone, who was a great guest, really funny comedian and great guy. As I mentioned last week, I am taking December off, so we'll be running best of episodes. Our sponsor this week, as always, is BetterHelp.com, online counseling. And I want to read an email that I got from a listener who calls himself Phil from Thursdays. And he writes, "Hi, Paul, I know you are in part promoting a paid advertisement, but I want to say thank you so much for promoting BetterHelp and actually using it so I could be confident that it was good." And then I'm just going to condense this. He lost a bunch of people, just a bunch of deaths in a row, and was really struggling. And he writes, "I had not had any therapy for a couple of years and was in dire need as I'm at such a low ebb. And I joined BetterHelp and I can't overstate how amazing it's been. Also, as a UK resident, the time you can schedule works really great with the time difference. So I've had my sessions at like 7:30 and 9:30 at night, which is great and makes it feel a little more relaxing. As I've said a couple of times before, I'm so grateful for your show. Talking about my day-to-day life within the BetterHelp sessions has made me realize how healthy my coping mechanisms and mental health strategies are. And a big part of that is lessons learned from your show, along with really good therapy." Love it. Love it. So if you're interested in checking out BetterHelp.com, go to BetterHelp.com/mental. And include the slash metal part so that they know you came from this podcast. And then you can get the ball rolling within 48 hours with a vetted and licensed therapist. They are available globally, licensed in all 50 states in America. And highly, highly recommend it. So go to betterhelp.com/mental and you can get 10% off your first month of counseling. And here is that episode from 2011 with Eddie Pepitone. Welcome to episode 29 with my guest, Eddie Pepitone. I'm Paul Gilmartin. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour, an hour of honesty about all the battles in our heads, from medically diagnosed conditions to everyday compulsive negative thinking, feelings of dissatisfaction, disconnection, inadequacy, and that vague sinking feeling that the world is passing us by. You give us an hour, we'll give you a hot ladle of awkward and icky. This show is not meant to be a replacement for professional counseling. This is not a doctor's office. I'm a jackass that tells dick jokes. Think of it more as a waiting room that hopefully doesn't suck. Before we get to the interview with Eddie, a couple of notes. The website for this podcast is mentalpod.com. That's also the Twitter name you can follow me at. Go to the website. There's a forum. You can email me through there. You can take a survey. You can see how other people respond to the survey. And it's a great way to get to see that you are not alone and that we really are connected and so much more alike than you think we are. You can support the show non-financially by going to iTunes and giving us a good rating. That helps boost our ranking and that brings more people to the show. Blah, blah, blah. All right. It has been an interesting week, emotionally and mentally. I went to visit family, which is always always kind of emotionally taxing for me, especially being around my my mom. I'll talk about that later at the end of the show after the Eddie Pepitone interview. The other thing that was emotionally and mentally taxing was while I was out of town, I apparently had put up the episode with Teresa Strasser with an editing mistake in the introduction to her episode. Without going into too much detail, I said something. I was talking about another person who I interviewed that day who had thrown me for a loop and asked me to edit out stuff because it was too sexually explicit, made me feel creepy, made me feel bad about myself, so I felt compelled to talk about it. Well, in my cutting and editing and not always playing things back, I had left a part out, so it sounded like I was talking about Teresa. Teresa did not ask me to edit anything out from interview, from her interview, and anybody that knows her knows that that would be very unlike Teresa. And the email started pouring in saying, why would Teresa ask you to edit anything out? She's so open and honest, and she talks about everything in her book. Yeah, well, I realized that when I went back and listened to it on the road. I've since fixed it. The episode with the fixed intro is now up on iTunes. Apologies to Teresa for that. She was very confused, as were a lot of people. And her episode was such an amazing episode. It's the only, so far it's been the only episode of this show where I've broken down and started crying while I was editing it together. It was just where she talked about that moment when she called her dad and she was getting ready to take her own life because she just couldn't handle the pain anymore. You know, her ability to be honest about that touched not only me, but it touched a lot of listeners. And I got this email the next day from a woman named Missy who writes, I just wanted to thank you for having Teresa Strasser on your show. Like her, I was at the end of my road, and listening to her talk about the fact that her father would never be okay with her not being here stopped me in my tracks. I've been preparing to end my life, and hearing her say that made me realize that my mom would never be okay with my plans. I sat down and cried like she did, and have decided not to take my life. I'm not sure what to do, but at least I will be alive for the rest of my journey out of misery, if there is one. If you could let Teresa know how she helped me, I would appreciate it. Well, I immediately let Teresa know. I forwarded her the email, and she and I had a flurry of emails back and forth, basically talking about how lucky we feel to have had our pain benefit other people. And if there's one message I am happy this podcast gets across, it's that keeping our pain locked up inside of us and never sharing it in a healthy way not only makes our lives more difficult, but we deprive other people of the knowledge that they're not alone. So thank you, Missy. And I just feel really, really lucky to have been chosen by the universe to do this show. You know, the decision to commit suicide, to me, is the ultimate example of how time, the perception of time, can distort reality and the truth. Because what is suicide but a reaction to the belief that things are never going to get better, and that we know how the universe is going to unfold and it's not going to be good. And Eckhart Tolle, who you guys know that listen to the show, know I love his writing, and his book, A New Earth, really has changed my life. There's so many profound things in it, and I just like to read a little bit about what he says about time. He says, time is the horizontal dimension of life, the surface layer of reality. Then there is the vertical dimension of depth, accessible to you only through the portal of the present moment. Well, that's easier said than done, but I can tell you this much. On the few days when I'm able to stay out of the past and the future and just be in the present moment, have my head exactly where my feet are, and be focused on whatever it is right in front of me, that fear falls away, and the feeling that I'm going to be okay comes through, and that's where I want to be at. And I hope that makes sense, and if it doesn't, go fuck yourself.
Everybody, yeah. I know is bizarrely, beautifully fucked up in some weird way.
I couldn't stand you in the audition.
I couldn't stand you.
Yes, yeah. Awful. Yeah. I was drunk.
And I learned that I could solve my problems.
And said.
Through violence, since I couldn't communicate.
Lonely?
Yes. I'm afraid that my genitalia is ugly.
That's hurtful.
And what was your role in the robbery?
I mean, you never knew what you were going home to.
I had a jar that had teeth in it.
I was a wreck.
Other people's teeth?
Yeah.
I'm here with my friend Eddie Pepitone. I always like to start off by saying how long I've known somebody, where I know them from. I've known you since we did a show at the UCB about called the Red State Raiders. It was a political satire show with
Matt Besser.
Matt Besser
created it.
Matt Walsh. Andy Daly, Ian Roberts directed it.
It was an all-star cast.
Michael
there.
Bush. Who else was in it?
You know, that's part of my mental illness is memory.
Yeah.
For me, I don't know what it is. I think I have basically emotional memory because that was kind of an even-keeled experience. And I don't remember even-keeled things. Do you know what I mean?
Really? Yeah, yeah.
I know, because I have friends who are amazing at remembering, you know, this actor was in this, this was in this. And another amazing block I have is I have no idea what years things happened. This has kind of freaked me out recently. A lot of my friends know the chronology of their lives. I have a really bad sense of that.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know what that is. I think it's feeling, you know, I have a lot of anxiousness, and I think it doesn't allow me to remember things.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe it because you're so, this is my dime store theory, but you're so filled with anxiety during the moment that you don't fully absorb the moment because your mind is always halfway somewhere else.
Yes.
Is that possible?
That is possible, too.
And I'm going to go ahead and write that up, see if I can't get some grant money to continue that, and then write that into a thesis. Either that or...
Hey, who's this Gil Martin guy with this theory, Al? Well, throw him a couple of grand, but no more. I mean, it seems like it's been done.
People would know you, I think, probably most recognizably as one of the pledges in Old School. Is that what you get recognized mostly from?
Not really.
No? What do people mostly recognize you
know,
from?
I think the two most things I get are, it's been changing because of the internet, but our Sarah Silverman show, where I was a regular, semi-regular, and Last Comic Standing, believe it or not, which is a show I did not care for, but I did it twice to get some exposure, and people remember me. I was on the first season of Last Comic Standing, and I can't believe I made such an impression. I wish I had better management.
You do make an impression on people. You are a you. Oh yeah, absolutely, and a good one. You're how would I describe you?
Be gentle,
volatile
here.
In a loving way. The most you're the most lovely volatile person that I know. Your volatility is never it's usually self-directed. That's one of the things that I like about you. There's many things that I like about you, but there's I don't know, there's an honesty to you. One of the reasons
when I ask people to come be best guests on the mm-hmm. podcast, I'm always looking for somebody that A, has some type of anxiety or battle in their head, and you and I talk all the time about stuff yeah. like that. So I knew that was a no brainer. But they have to be able to articulate it and be able to be kind of brutally honest about things about themselves.
Yeah.
That's what makes a great guest for me, and I've always known you as having those three things.
Well, I've cultivated that because of stand-up. Yeah. Like, I am that type of stand-up. I'm not a good one-linery type of writer.
Right.
My stand-up just comes out of my angst.
Yeah, it's strikes me as very cathartic because it just comes pouring out of you.
You know how I know it's cathartic? When I've got it down to this. If I don't perform for three nights, I actually get depressed.
Really?
I've gotten better because I used to have to perform almost every night.
Yeah.
And maybe three or four nights. Maybe I'm up to four nights where I don't have to perform. But it used to be I take a couple of nights off. And I guess because I wasn't getting my craziness out and getting some kind of validation too, for it.
Yeah. Well, let's. You're from where? New York.
I was born in Brooklyn. At the age of nine, my dad moved us.
You were saying I was born at the age of nine. I was like,
I was kept in an incubation pod until nine. My dad didn't want to release me. No. I was born in Brooklyn, and then at nine we moved to Staten Island, which was the country to my dad, another borough of New York that was actually kind of rural, but it only lasted a couple of years. And then I was stuck in Staten Island, which is kind of a cultural wasteland. And then I moved out of Staten Island and lived all over New York City until I escaped and got to LA at the age of, I think it was 41.
Mm-hmm. And what was your family like?
My mother, unfortunately, very sweet and gentle, but very depressed. My mom was clinically depressed. I believe she was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and she actually went through some of the horrible stuff because it was back in, I think, the late 50s, early 60s, electroshock. She went through briefly.
Yeah. Although, and I guess that can do good sometimes.
Well, you know, I don't know. I thought it was universally barbaric.
They still do it today. I think it's as a kind of a last resort. But
that's terrible.
Yeah.
You know what I realized about mental illness? I was just not to get away from my family, but I was at the supermarket here, Ralph's, the other day. And there was a big guy who was obviously had lost it a little bit. And people don't know what to do with people who were untethered. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? No one wants to grab them physically. There's all kind, you know, it's just a strange thing.
There was a guy last night, I was hanging out with a group of people. And this guy wandered in, and it was a semi-public place. And this guy wandered in and this person sitting next to me said, oh, that guy's mentally ill. He lives in the neighborhood. And he sat down and people who didn't know he was mentally ill, I could see them getting up and moving away from this guy. And apparently he had just farted really loudly. And then he would just get up and he would walk across the room to complete strangers and go to shake their hand. And yeah,
it is amazing how scared people.
Yeah, because you don't know is this the sweet, lovable guy that wouldn't hurt a fly, or is this guy going to go get a butcher knife?
Yeah,
you don't know.
Yeah.
So it's just to hedge my bets, I beat the shit out of him.
You took matters into your own hands.
I had to.
Well, you probably have a life coach who tells you to be proactive.
No, it's funny. Some people actually escorted this guy out of the room because he started.
Where
to,
was it?
He started to freak people. I was just a gathering of friends, support group.
Okay.
And
Yeah, man. It's strange how people are so scared of people who aren't abiding by the normal rules of behavior. I grew up with that kind of stuff, though. My mom also was one of the first, not one of the first, but she was at the beginning of, all these pharmaceuticals, like at the beginning of some pharmaceuticals.
Oh, is this when they would throw Valium and stuff at depression?
I think she had that, but she had, you know, I wish I could remember what, but my mom was on, lithium. She,
They still use that.
They still use lithium, right?
Yeah, I think.
What's the word on lithium?
I think lithium is used mostly as a leveler for people that are bipolar.
And she was they either called her bipolar or manic depressive. Is there a difference?
I think it's the same thing. I like that I do a podcast on mental illness and I don't know any of that stuff.
But I'll tell you, it was rough because I'll never forget, you know, my mom was just checked out a lot of the time because of the depression, and now I'm in therapy and I'm dealing with how angry I am
that she wasn't there. It was just the body was there, and
I'm still fucking furious over this.
Furious at the universe, or furious at her, or furious at yourself?
It all intertwines. I mean, I am not furious. I don't think I'm furious at her as much because she died 5 or 6 years ago. And it's hard to be furious. And that's another thing. It was really hard to be furious at my mom because the way it would go is I would get angry and then she would be, instead of, me having someone to fight with, she would, check out of that as well and act very hurt. And so it was a real manipulative thing,
man. You think she was consciously kind of manipulating?
Well,
it?
You know what?
It felt that way to you.
Yeah, it felt real frustrating that here I am, someone probably with legitimate rage that this person wasn't there. My mother. Never mind this person. Yeah. It was my mother.
Yeah.
And then I would get angry and she would, be like, leave me, Eddie, leave me. And it just breaks all of it breaks my heart. You know what I mean? All of it just breaks my heart. And it's the reason I'm a comedian. Because the only way to deal with that is either to kill yourself or, have a very...
Or get a tight 10 together and take it on the road. Either way, there's killing is going to happen, right? You're either going to kill other people with your act.
No, I mean, I think it really does. It really is about me wanting attention. I mean, I am like the classic. I've realized this. I am the classic comedian in that sense, is that I fucking am desperate for attention.
What is the thing you said something about a tweet? Or was it a joke that you have about?
Was it about my shrink? Where I say one of my tweets was, "My shrink committed suicide today." Yes, I win.
That wasn't it, but that's a great one. It was. You made some really honest joke about needing the validation of people retweeting you or something.
Oh yeah,
and I just I was just another reason to love Eddie.
Sometimes that honesty on stage freaks people out. People don't want that exposed.
But that's what makes you on stage. And you work you work quite a bit. You're in demand, and I always see you on people's shows. I see you on TV shows here and there. Apparently, I didn't see you on the two things that you're known for, Sarah Silverman and the other thing. But
I don't get that much because I really was kind of a background guy.
Oh, okay.
In that, even though
you were in a lot of scenes.
I was in a lot of scenes, and it was really a cool experience. It's what brought me out to L.A. Just being in that movie
Wait, back up.
Yeah.
You came out here to do that movie?
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah, because
I just assumed you'd been here for
No, not at all. I was hanging out, of course, with the UCB Upright Citizens Brigade Theater in New York, and one of the co-writers of Old School is Scott Armstrong, and he's co-written stuff with Todd Phillips. And he just said, "Hey, we would like you to be one of the guys in the fraternity. Would you be into that?" And I'd be like, and I was like, "Would I?" Yeah.
It's the whole reason you get into show business is for that somebody to ask you that kind of question. Hey, could I put you in a movie? Who says no to that?
Yeah, but he was like, you know, and people always do this. It's a small part. And, you know, I'm not, you know, I've never been able to go, well, you know what? Fuck you then.
Right.
I want to get to that point where I just go around, you know, really brandishing my mental illness. Yeah. Like, fuck you.
Yeah.
No, there's only 7 scenes with me in it, and I'm not prominent. I've been reading the old Hollywood biographies of people, and it's just insane what goes on.
Yeah.
Egos.
Yeah. I had somebody call me one time that was doing a movie, and it was kind of a self-finance thing, and they called me, and they said, hey, and I knew that they were doing this movie, and my original co-host on Dinner in a Movie was Annabelle, was in this movie. And so I was like, oh, they're going to ask me to be in the movie. And they thought it would be cool, just for the inside joke, that I'm a background extra in this thing. And
for
it just hurt
inside joke?
And it just hurt my feelings so badly, because I was like, I'm sorry, I just can't. I didn't say this to them. I said, you know, I can't make it, but the thought of sitting in the background as an extra at a restaurant while my co-host was one of the stars of this thing, just, I don't
know. How are you now with ego?
I still struggle with it, because even when things are going good, like this podcast is an example of something that is creatively really good and in my opinion kind of pure and comes from a good place and feels like it's the right place for me to be. My ego is constantly trying to get its little barnacles on it and worry about the popularity of it this and that.
Well, we live in such an age of where it can be monitored so quick, like with the counting.
Yeah.
The counting.
Yeah.
How many followers do you have? How many downloads do you have?
Yeah. And in so many ways, that's the enemy of
creativity.
Art.
But, yeah.
But it's also what drives us. So maybe we wouldn't do it if we didn't know that there would be counting involved.
I don't know about that. I mean,
you would never do comedy if nobody, you know, showed up at a comedy club. But I guess that's different than counting, because we need their laughter.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But would you consistently show up to a comedy club where you're guaranteed there was only going to be 2 people? Because you're still giving people something, right?
Yeah, big time. No, I mean, we need people to fucking hear what we do, man.
Right. Yeah.
You know, big time.
But I want to go back to when you were growing up and you had this depressed mom. What was a typical day like? Was she just lay in bed all day and you would...
That was the saddest thing. By the way, and then the dynamic, and just to round out the dynamic, my mom, Jewish, Russian, German Jew, and my dad, Sicilian, so... You know, the Italian.
You got the guilt coming from both angles.
Big time.
Was he Catholic?
They weren't overtly religious in any way, but his parents were, you know.
It's seeped into your pores. It doesn't matter.
Even
if you don't go, it's in your code.
Exactly. You know, if you're Catholic, the Pope has harmed you in some way. Vatican City's a country, you know. I just found that out. But juxtapose, you know, because my mom was checked out and bipolar, it was very, very frustrating for my dad, who then, and this was rough, he put all his emotional eggs in me. I have one sister.
Older, younger?
She is younger. She is a lawyer and doesn't talk to me. And that's another collateral. That
happened
about...
Because you got all dad's attention?
No. We just had a major falling out around my mom's death. yeah, and it was fucking intense. Like, just to fight the family dynamic, because my mom, here's how, you know, what happened. My mom checked out, and so my dad puts all his emotional eggs in a basket, and he was, like, just so too involved with me, you know, like my grades and, you know, for company and that kind of thing. And
what do you mean for company?
He didn't like me leaving. He didn't like me leaving to go out and hang out with my buddies when I was, 13, 14, that kind of thing. Very kind of like,
wanted you in the prison with him.
Yes. Man, I've had a lot of work. I love my dad. I talk to him a lot, and I'm going home in a few days to hang out with him. He's getting up there. He's like 77. By the way, I that's, you know, my memory's so bad. I don't know when my mom died. I'm not sure how old my dad is. I don't know if I should be laughing at that. You know, and I've been told, you know, and I just never fucking remember. But my dad, I think, is 77. Yeah, he was hyper critical of me growing up, and he
your dad was,
yeah,
and then wanted you to be his buddy.
Yes,
so that had to feel really awkward because A, you didn't want to be in the house because your mom is there in a bummed out mood, and
yeah,
did you not feel safe around your dad emotionally because he had a history of being hypercritical?
I mean, and my dad also could be, my dad also had like Sicilian operatic anger as well. You know, my dad loved
what
opera.
What was his key range of his anger? Could he hit a high C in anger?
I can give you an example. Where are my keys? It was always about his goddamn keys.
Yeah.
And glasses. Where are my glasses? You know what's really fucked up too? I don't know if you have this experience, but I have this incredible dread come over me because I am now in a monogamous relationship living with my girlfriend, and I catch myself being just like my dad.
Like in what way?
I'll be like, honey, where's my glasses? Like, where did you see my keys? I am looking for the same things that my dad did. And also my temper, too,
yeah.
Sometimes in my relationship. My temper is like I have flash anger, and my dad did, too. And I'm always like, oh, my God, am I really becoming? Have I become my dad, you know? But, yeah, when I was a kid, I swear to God, I don't even remember that much the real young ages, except that it was scary. It was scary because my mom wasn't there to protect me, and my dad was a loose cannon. I luckily survived. My grandmother and my grandparents, my dad's grandparents, my Italian grandparents were so lovely, and they took care of me in a lot of ways. You know, when I would go over there, I felt like my grandmother was like my maternal figure. Yeah. I always wondered why my dad was so fucked up, because I loved his parents.
Right.
They seemed so and I don't know if it's that thing, because it's once removed, you know, there's that perfect, yeah, you know, removal. It's like you're not, you know, whereas the parents, you know, are too critical when they're too close, blah, blah, blah. But so it was scary. It was scary growing up in that. You
isn't
know?
It funny how sometimes I should just say that there's been so many guests on the podcast who were abandoned by both parents. And by the both thing that wound up saving them was some other relative.
Yeah.
Or a sibling. But yeah, a lot of times it was a grandparent.
You know, the way families are now, I mean, I'm not a great student of history, but it used to be extended families would raise children. Mm-hmm. Extended family. And I understand the wisdom in that, because there's so much pressure now on people raising their kids without the help of, you know, family around them.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, I never, and by the way, because of the way I grew up, I have never had kids. I'm 52. I feel a little bad about that lately. Mm-hmm. Lately, I've been feeling a little bad about that. You remember the scene in Into the Wild where Hal Holbrook is talking to the kid? Do you remember that?
He's
like, look, I got no one. I want you to be my son. I feel like I'm going to be Hal Holbrook with some fucking waif, like some waif running through Los Angeles, and I'll be at the end of my comedy thing, and I'll just have him in, you know, my Mini Cooper going, look, I never had anybody.
It'll probably be James Franco or some shit.
I so get that. I have it. Well, you know what? Maybe this would be a good place to do the fear off.
I'd like to see the Kardashians do a fear off.
The listeners, I would imagine the Kardashians, one of their fears is not having constant attention.
Yes.
Is that a leap of logic to get there? So the people that are new to the show, Fear Off is my guest and I trade fears until one of us runs out. And because I've listed probably over 100 fears of
mine, I don't have that
already.
But I listed some, but I'll come up with...
You can improvise some. But these have to be things that we genuinely have anxiety about, thoughts that we have anxiety about. And because I've done so many of my fears, I go and use some of the listeners' fears that they've sent in.
Bastard.
Yeah, because I've drained some of my supply. But I've still got a bunch here. So I'll kick it off. I'm afraid that I'm annoying past female guests by asking them to help me find future female guests, and one might even wish she had never agreed to do the podcast because I'm so annoying and needy.
That is such a specific fear.
Yeah.
The ocean.
Yeah.
For me.
Is it?
I am so scared. I've kind of a little bit gotten over it, but just the immensity and the unknown in the ocean. And I have a huge fear of drowning in the ocean.
Yeah.
Currents. I recently went to Nantucket a few years ago. And
was there a guy blowing himself?
Is that in a limerick?
There's been a rumor flying around about this gentleman and his long penis that I have been trying to get to the bottom of. So go ahead.
There's a lot of money in Nantucket.
You're in Nantucket.
No, and it was a thing where I went out swimming and I was like, oh, this is cool. And then I started to swim in and I couldn't swim in.
I've been there.
The current wouldn't let me swim.
Riptide, yeah.
It wouldn't let me. And what happens to me is I immediately get warm with fear.
Mm-hmm.
Prickly.
I think that's called urine.
I had already urinated like crazy. That's why I go in the ocean.
Yeah.
You know. No, but like just that intense.
You feel the blood
shift.
I was
put on medication for panic attacks many years ago.
Yeah.
So that felt like, that was like, whoa, panic, like intense panic. So I feel like I'm going to die in the ocean is
so a fear. How did you make your way in? You just fought it?
You know what? Yes. And here's another classic thing is my friends, where I was screaming to them to help, and they
and
thought,
it's so hard because you're out of breath also,
and plus, you know, you think you're closer than you are. Mm-hmm. But they couldn't hear, and they were just looking at me waving.
And you're flailing, and they're like, boy, Eddie really loves to wave, doesn't he?
And then I don't know what happened. There must have been a break in the riptide, and I was able to kind of get in, but I was like, and then once I hit land, I am like, Jesus Christ, why did I panic that much? Because they tell you just to kind of go with it, you know?
If you go parallel to the beach.
Parallel, that's what they say.
You'll get out of there, because the riptides are usually at the most maybe 10, 20 yards wide.
Right. And there's the thing, that I don't have the wherewithal to do stuff like that.
Yeah.
Because once the panic hits me, I am the idiot who fucks things up for everybody. If I was in a group situation... Yeah. I'm the guy in the movies who is like, no, why is Al? No, Al, don't do that. You're supposed to go parallel. Bullshit. That'd be me.
I know that feeling, though. I was about 20 something years old, and my family, we were vacationing in Mexico, And it was just kind of this remote beach. And I think I might have even been by myself. But there was, I remember there was nobody kind of around. And I was about 15 yards into the water. And the waves were like head high. And I'm swimming. And I'm not getting any closer. And so I'm putting everything I have into it. And I'm starting to freak out. And then waves are crashing on top of me. And I'm losing my breath. And
I'm getting nervous just hearing the story.
Somehow I made my way to the beach, and I just remember collapsing, breathing as hard as I could, and just violently shaking.
Right.
And then masturbating.
You just described my adolescence. Shaking violently, then masturbating. That was, you know, a large part of my life.
I was kidding, were you?
Not really.
No?
Oh, man, did I masturbate a lot? I think my fear, I don't know where if you talk about this shit.
Oh, I'm
shit,
sorry, but we get off on the fear off, but we'll get back to it after this thought.
Just the intensity of my fucking masturbation as a troubled kid. Yeah. You know, I would masturbate till my cock was bleeding.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it was a big, you know, it was a big.
How many times a day would you?
Was
it multiple times a day?
Yeah.
I think that's normal for teenage kids. I did it once or twice a day.
Yeah. And then here's another fear for me. Where do you go?
I go. Okay. I go now. And we don't have to comment on each one as we do it unless you feel like it needs elaboration.
Yeah.
Or you have a question about mine or I have a question about yours, because sometimes it makes it drag on too long.
Got it.
I feel that I will never feel inspired again, and everything will be an effort.
I feel like there, every time I hear footsteps near my apartment door, I think someone is going to get into my house and beat me to death.
Oh, that's a good one. I like that one. I'm afraid that I will start looking at pornography again, especially things that make me feel creepy, like Girls Gone Wild.
Yeah, I have a tremendous fear of winding up in jail, being arrested for something that I really didn't commit, and just being in jail. I have a tremendous fear of just being incarcerated.
I have a fear that spammers will destroy my website's forum irreparably.
I have a fear every time the phone rings in my apartment, I think it's going to be bad news.
Mm-hmm. I'm afraid that I'm a much worse person than I think I am, and I won't find out until it's too late.
Yours cracked me up, by the way. I have a terrible fear. I have five cats. I have a terrible fear that one of them is going to die abruptly.
Wouldn't it be worse if they died a slow, painful death?
Yeah, but I mean, what I mean by that is that they're
young.
You
won't see it coming.
Yeah, that they're young and they're going to be taken from me.
I'm afraid that I'm underestimating how long my unemployment will last.
I'm afraid of extreme heat. I get really scared when we have a heat wave.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I can't breathe. I can.
Yeah.
But I feel like, wait a minute, this isn't good.
Yeah.
This isn't, like, that's my,
yeah.
This isn't good.
I'm afraid that I've pushed a close friend away by being a know-it-all.
I am afraid of getting a heart attack. Constantly afraid of that. Not constantly.
I'm afraid that whenever I think I'm being charming, I'm actually being annoying and exhausting.
I'm afraid, so afraid of aging and my body betraying me and falling apart.
I'm afraid people will think that I think of myself as a guru.
I'm afraid of being beaten to death. I just think that can happen at any time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're right about that one. I'm the guy that just shovels coal into other people's fears. I'm afraid I will let the nice things people say about the podcast inflate my ego and come to think of myself as being bigger or better or more important than I am.
I'm afraid that I will not have the energy to exercise and take care of myself in general. I'm afraid that I will, that I don't have the energy to live a good life. And I think that's related to growing up with depression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Feeling lethargic and unmotivated.
Yeah. I have a great fear of doing what I have to do every day. I just have a fear of it. Yeah,
fear of responsibility.
I have a fear of responsibility.
Yeah, yeah, I do too. That's a great one. That can be paralyzing. And I think that's connected to, and we've talked about this on the podcast, I think that's connected to perfectionism. That the fear that if we can't do it perfectly, we shouldn't be doing it. And I think that really is...
Perfectionism is such a crippler.
It's insidious.
And what I am learning is to just put 1 foot literally on the treadmill, because now I've been going to the gym and, you know, I feel this anxiety on the way to the gym or thinking about the gym, like, oh, I've got to go to the gym today. And it seems like such a burden. And I can equate that also with writing. I have such tremendous anxiety with writing. Like, I love to improvise on stage, and that's where most of my comedy comes from. But to sit down and to build something, whether it's a story, a joke, or a table, is crippling to me.
Yeah.
But I've been learning literally to just put 1 foot in front of the other, you know, realize that it's, you know, I do what I can do, and it's usually okay.
Yeah. And sometimes the mistakes, or what we think of as mistakes in the building or the doing of that, is where we learn how to do something better.
Exactly.
You know, I one of my hobbies is making furniture, and sometimes I'll design a piece of furniture and I'll be halfway into making it and I'll have the afternoon off and I'll be excited at one moment to go in there and build it. Then I'll get this panic that I'm going to ruin it, or I'm going to make the wrong decision about the length or shape of something, and I'll have to take a nap, and I won't even go in there. And I'll just... Now, I was pointing out to Eddie before we sat down to tape this, about three-quarters of the furniture in our living room here is furniture that I designed and built. And Eddie pointed to a frame across the room of the Blackhawks having won the Stanley Cup. And it took me a year, because my depression has been bad, it took me a year just to hang that picture. It sat there, and I would say, I gotta hang that.
You know, that is an amazing thing. Just to hang a fucking picture took a year, and I totally relate to that. Like, right now, this is similar, is that I'm supposed to fax, and I have a fax machine in my place, fax two things in for insurance purposes.
Yeah.
It's been 3 weeks.
I so get that.
It's been 3 weeks, and I am crippled by the fact that I don't know where these papers are.
Yes. Oh, my God, do I relate to that. Oh, my God, do I relate to that.
And instead of looking for these papers, they're probably in a couple of spots. They might be in a couple of spots. This is what happens. I go, oh, my God, they're not right next to my bed.
Yes.
Where the fuck could they? And then I've got, oh my God.
Fear of the wasting of the time of looking for that. And then the worst is, on the way to looking for that, you're going to see that something else needs to be done. And before you know it, 4 things have been added to your to-do list, and you can't
even... You know,
even
that is a very interesting that you just pointed out, that on the way to do something, you see something else has to be done, and that has really hit me lately. Every time I don't know what this is, but every time I go to do something in my apartment, I'm on... Here's just a typical one. I'm going to feed the cats. And on my way to feeding the cats, I'm like, oh, but first I need some soy nuts. I need some protein right now. And like, it's like...
And there's no soy nuts.
Yeah, all this kind of shit. Like, I can never just... I have to consciously will myself, no, just feed the cats.
Yeah. Yeah.
Feed, and that's just a metaphor for everything. Right. Yeah. Just write for an hour.
Yeah.
Like, the idea of me writing for an hour is just monumental.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
I'm gonna go pay the electricity bill. There's no pens. You know, that's, so now I've got to go get pens. Oh, there's no gas in the car. So now all of a sudden I'm at the gas station. All I wanted to do was pay the light bill, and I still have to fill up the car.
You know
car.
What I think is behind the whole thing? Is that we feel like we're wasting our life.
Yes, that we're behind, we're three steps behind the universe to begin with, and all this other stuff is just proving to us that we're so much further behind than we think we are.
Yeah, it's a crazy thing. Like, I think one fear off, biggest fear, not enough time.
That's a good one.
There's not enough time in my life.
I am afraid that my dream to write a book will never come true. Mm.
I am afraid that I will never reach the level of recognition that I want.
Oh, that's a great one. I'm afraid that I will write a book and it will be awful and I will have wasted my time.
By the way, and that's the thing that I understand, and you think you hit on it before, is that we have to make mistakes. I've heard from everyone that, you know, your first draft of a book is necessarily horrible, or a screenplay. Right. That's another thing, because we're out here in LA, mm-hmm. and one of the things everybody does is write a screenplay.
Yeah.
But you have to be willing to write something that is far from perfect.
Yeah.
And if you're a perfectionist, you're screwed.
And here's the other thing that I think is the second barrel of that shotgun that kills you. The one barrel is the perfectionism, and the other barrel is grandiosity. And the grandiosity, the letdown of writing something that is not good. I mean, the perfectionism is, I know, I right. think they're just
by
different
the way,
sides
yeah,
of the
I
same
think
coin.
You totally. Totally, because that hits home for me, because I have such grandiosity that when I have like a bad set, that grandiosity gets punctured. And the flip side of grandiosity, what is the flip side? It's
humility, maybe.
Yeah, that's the healthy side of grandiosity. Yeah. But what happens is that I think, this is what I wanted to get to, is that I think I'm so great. But if I have a bad set that night or a mediocre set, I go from thinking I am the best ever to I am
the worst ever.
Or just a fraud, right. that I am kidding myself,
right.
that I am some great comedian. No, 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 no. Mm-hmm. You are fucking, if lucky, you're mediocre.
You're so deluded, ha ha.
You're fucking deluded.
And to me, grandiosity is like even worse than perfectionism, because it's like perfectionism with impatience. You know, you could be if you were a patient perfectionist, that might be livable, because you can work your way towards doing something perfectly. You can refine it and refine it. But grandiosity, you want it perfect at the first try. You expect it to be perfect right out of the gate, and that's so draining. But grandiosity, in your fantasy, grandiosity is so comforting, because it tells us we're special.
See, that's the thing. That's, you know, mental illness. That is the root, I think, of my mental illness, is that I never felt like I was special, you know, in a nurtured way.
Right.
I never got that. And so now, as an adult, I have this intense desire to be extra special.
Yeah.
And to be, basically what I am screaming, and this might be a funny thing to scream on stage in my physical form now at 52, just come on stage and be, I am special.
That's hilarious.
I am extra special.
That's hilarious, Eddie.
Yeah, I think that's
great.
Really funny. And then folks, maybe, and address them. Like, what were you going to say?
And afterwards, say, folks, I just thought it was a time my ego got a little stage time.
I've actually wanted to do a one-man show of a blue-collar infant, which is just, I am, you know, a couple of months old, but I'm just like, hey, mommy. Like, I have a cigar. And I'm like, mommy, come on, pay a little attention to me, you know? Like, and I don't know, I haven't developed it yet in my head, but
Maybe mommy's management in your labor.
Without a doubt.
You know, that's where the tension is. I'm afraid that an unstable listener will kill me.
Oh, I have that too.
Yeah.
Like a fan or, you know. Mm-hmm. I have a fear that I am going to be killed for my political beliefs.
Yes, I do too. I do too. I fear that there will be a civil war, and then they will go through all the stuff that exists now on the internet, take stuff I've said, either in context out of context, and I will be tortured in a prison.
Same here.
Yeah.
And we're probably not far away from that in this country.
I'm afraid that I will have to get a job that drains my soul.
Mm. Boy, do I have that one as well. I am deathly afraid that I am unattractive.
I think everybody fears that one.
Oh, well.
Actually, some people probably don't.
No.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to go to a tweeter, Danny, mm-hmm. Tweets that I'm afraid my son will have migraines regularly now that he has had his first one.
Ooh. Yeah. Afraid. You see, we're so protective of, you know, the things we love and the mm-hmm. people. Like, we don't want anything bad to happen. I've been working on you know, Buddhist Zen acceptance of things. And there are so many levels and layers of acceptance. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, just accept life, you know? And I was listening to Ram Dass. I love to listen to Eckhart Tolle, Power of Now, and Ram Dass and all these like big spiritual mm-hmm. thinkers. And Ram Dass said, look, embrace all. And he talks like this too. He's very soothing to listen to in the iPod when I'm power walking, not to brag, in the park. And you hear Ram Dass just going, you know, you got to love it all. Not only the death of an infant, but the birth of an infant happens at the same time. The beautiful, playful dolphin and genocide. It's all part of one, you know, like just.
That's deep. That's really deep. And I agree.
But that's life.
It is life. And you have to really, if you're going to totally, totally be in acceptance and really find any lasting sanity or peace, you have to be okay with all of that. That doesn't mean you approve of it. It means
that's the trick.
Yes.
To not, the Buddhists say, I think they have three things. They say, do not judge, and that's do not resist. Do not resist anything. Mm-hmm. Do not judge. And I always forget the third one. Yeah. I think it's
do not forget anything. That's the third one. Now, I wonder, would a Buddhist say, well, does that mean you shouldn't resist Hitler? Would they say you shouldn't resist Hitler? Or do they mean you shouldn't resist anything you don't have control over?
Yes. No, it's like, accept the fact that Hitler exists, and that I think this is
and
it is.
Do what work you can
and that, yes,
to stop him.
Yes, exactly.
But if he puts you in a concentration camp and you can't escape, accept the fact that you are in that concentration camp and make the best of it and see how you can be a healthier
fellow
man. Yeah,
and by the way, this line of thinking that you're doing right now is what keeps me from accepting anything. I'm serious, because I'm meditating. You want to fear off again. I am afraid that I am meditating wrong and that I am wasting my time. And that line of thought about, do I accept evil? Like, it keeps me from accepting anything, because if I accept everything, then I'm accepting, you know, vicious, evil people and vicious evil acts and atrocities, and I don't want to accept that.
No, I don't think. I think you accept the evil that you can't control, and
right.
I think that is a sane thing to do. An insane thing to do is to think that you can change something that you have no control over. I think you. Mm-hmm. I think to keep your sanity, you also have to work towards stopping evil. Put your effort into making the world a better place, but then let go of the results of what happens.
I think the Buddhists always say, too, is that peace in the world starts with you, mm-hmm. because I'm very aware of my anger. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like in LA, especially driving, like I can be such an angry guy in the car and do unkind things like beep, yell out the window, like, mm-hmm. like I contribute to the aggressiveness and the crap that is out there. And so what they say is, no, 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 fix that.
Yeah.
When you fix that, then you will be helping the world.
Right. Like people that go to, you know, the stereotypical actor that goes to India to become more spiritual.
You're talking about Richard Gere?
It makes me laugh because mm-hmm. to me, you know, that if you want to call it a journey or whatever to be more spiritual, that starts with letting the person in front of you in traffic. On the way to the airport to go to India. You know, there's 100 right. things that you could right. do before you even get to the airport to go to India to do that that could last a lifetime.
Well, I think that comes under the heading of you can do it right now. Like mm-hmm. everybody, like people are like, no, no, I'll get enlightened when.
Right.
I'll get enlightened when I'm in India. Yeah. I'll get enlightened when I finally get the gig that will give me enough money to relax to get enlightened.
Yeah. It's insanity to think that something externally is going to bring you enlightenment. I think enlightenment has to come from an inner acceptance of what is and a commitment to principles.
Yeah. But you know what's hard about that? Is to do that, you have to stop lying to yourself. That's yes. what I've realized.
Yes.
Like, I have to stop lying to myself about the fact that I have more money than I have, for instance.
Right.
I have to have the courage. It takes a lot of courage to yes. accept what is. Yes. Like, I have to have the courage to accept that, I don't have a lot of money.
Yeah.
Just accept that on that level.
But if you can accept that you're okay with the amount of money that you have,
right.
it's easier to accept. But if buried deep in your head is this belief that I will not be okay if I don't have X amount of money, then mm-hmm. it makes it impossible to accept that you will be okay with whatever. So if you can get mm-hmm. to a place where you can accept your worst fears, picture your worst fears and accept
yeah.
them coming true and yeah. know that you can find a place in there to find peace and joy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what I've realized is that my fears are all in my imagination. You know that old Mark Twain quote, which is, there have been bad things in my life, and some have actually happened. And
yes.
And what he means by that is that they're in our fucking head.
Yeah.
Like, if I can just be here. I mean, like, right now, me and you are on these, you know, couches, and, yeah. you know, we're surrounded by imperfect furniture.
Yeah.
And that you made, and we're fine.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Yeah, one of my previous guests, Paula Newman, the woman that taught me meditation, she has a great quote that if life is 100%, 1% of it is the event, and 99% of it is us obsessing about how that event relates to us, and
yeah.
that just how distorted our perception of how things affect us are. You know, in reality, it's...
You know what I realize is that I'm really afraid to let go of my ego. I'm really afraid to just, you know, let go of this part of me that wants to be recognized and someone, because then I'll feel like, well hold it. What is, you know, I just...
Otherwise, what do I have to look forward to other than that dream?
Or I don't want to be someone who's just... You know, just another person. You know, I want to be
But what's the matter? And I get it. I totally understand that. I've occasionally gotten to a place where I'm okay with being one of many. And the idea that I will maybe die not being special, not being written about, not being remembered by anybody other than close friends. And I've had moments where I'm completely at peace with that, and it's such a beautiful place to be. And then somehow I get out of it, and I get back into, I don't have enough Twitter followers, I'm a piece of shit,
yeah.
my show was canceled, I'm a joke, I haven't planned for the future, I'm fucked, I'm not going to have health insurance. I'm going to be in a rickety wheelchair begging for money. And people are going to go, oh my God, that's the guy that used to be on Dinner in a Movie. And then I'm sitting in the living room staring at the wall, unable to hang the Black Hawk picture. I'm not kidding, Eddie.
No, I know you're not kidding. And I am laughing out of complete recognition. And I also just finished W. Field's biography. And Fields.
I like that you dropped the C in his name because you don't have time.
W.C. Fields?
Yeah.
What did I say?
W. Fields.
Did I?
You're behind.
I just read
you're behind the eight ball.
I just read a 500-page book on W.C. Fields, and the last couple of pages I read last night,
that's why you're behind in doing all the things. You're reading 500-page biographies on W.C. Fields.
I love the old Hollywood stars.
And there's nothing better than a good biography. Last night, I was like, I'm going to get some work done. All of a sudden, I see that there's a documentary on Spencer Tracy, who I don't even give a shit about. Next thing I know, I'm eating macaroons at 2 a.m, watching a documentary on Spencer Tracy and loving it.
Yeah.
So go ahead. You're reading this thing about W.C. Fields.
Oh, well, and he, you know, you just told me your fears, and Fields was dying of cirrhosis in a home in Pasadena. Here's a brilliant, vibrant, you know, genius comedian. And he was visited that day by another brilliant guy, a guy named Tully, who was a great vaudevillian, whatever. And it was related by the woman who used to take care of Fields. And there were two women in there who were younger, and they both knew these guys' life stories. And Fields and Tully were incapacitated in wheelchairs, and they couldn't speak, but the women were like telling the anecdotes for them, and they would just kind of nod. And I was just thinking of how life goes, that, you know, we all will die. You know, now Fields wound up in that state because he drank too much. He just didn't take care of himself, you know. Yeah. Well, but he was incapacitated in a rickety wheelchair, you know.
Let's use this as a segue. I'm gonna say that you win that fear off.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, because
I like to win.
You did a good job. I had a pretty long list of my fears, and you outlasted me, and you made me go into the listener fear. So.
I knew my fears would come in handy one day.
They do. They do. But I wanted to switch gears and talk about addiction, because we were just talking about that. So I figured this would be a good time to talk about that. You've been off drugs and alcohol now for how long?
Well, I am now off of drugs and alcohol for 16 months, but I was off them for 7 years. And then I went back to smoking pot. I love pot. And I went back and then
what made you then stop again?
I would get panic attacks. Started getting panic attacks every time I smoked. But I think what was really going on was that I was like, if I keep smoking pot the way I smoke it, I will never make anything out of my life. What I'm doing is I am not honoring my gift. I am not honoring the gift I have, you know, the God-given gift of being someone who can really, you know, take the pain of life and turn it into something to laugh at. Because that's the gift of a comedian, is that, I mean, that is why I think comedians are really, I mean, comedians to me, maybe comedians and music are the, you know, most important things in life. You hear, oh, you have to have a sense of humor to get through life. And so what was going on with me was that I was smoking so much, I was not letting my gift live. And I was really panicked about that. Mm-hmm. So I quit. But I have I am such an addictive person. Mm-hmm. I am such an. I'm just laughing because I have 16 months clean. My latest addiction is frozen grapes. I put green and red grapes in the freezer.
Yeah.
But I don't eat them like a normal person. I take them out and I fucking just one after the other because I'm a pleasure. You know, addiction to me is all about take me to a state of pleasure. That's all it is for me. It's like, take me to a state of pleasure. Green grape.
And at the very least, take me out of this state that I'm in.
Yes.
I mean, who wants to go to of course, take me to a better state, ultimately a state of pleasure. But sometimes, you know, for people, like people who drinking stops working for, but they still continue to drink, it's still better than the state that they're in that tortured state of insanity.
I'll never forget when I tried to quit pot when I was younger. I'll never forget. I had like I didn't smoke for a couple of days, and I'll never forget being on a corner in New York City, like in Midtown, going, being so depressed. I had stopped for 2 days smoking pot, and I was a big smoker, and I'll never forget the thought of, oh my God, is this what it feels like to not be smoking?
Yeah.
Screw this.
Yeah.
I'm going back to smoking. So for me, what's great right now is that I feel so good most of the time about being, you know, not high. I think
it gives you a chance to be more human.
Totally. I'm really into that lately.
Yeah.
Even with the anxiety I'm feeling.
Right.
Like, I'm feeling a lot of anxiety. I've recently stopped Prozac. I was on Prozac for about 15 years. And I always kind of, like, Prozac was great when I first went on it. I'll never forget when I first went on Prozac. I know I'm going all over the place, but when I first went on Prozac, I'll never forget how energized I was. And I was like, oh my God, this is the answer. This is what my brain was missing. Because for the first month, I started jogging. I started writing. But then what happens, at least for me, was that then you level off and you're just like, oh, I don't feel particularly any better than I was. And then I get it into my head that, wait a minute, this Prozac is, you know, keeping me from being all I can be. Like, this is the kind of thought process, you know? But anyway, I've had a tough time being off it. I've been off it. I think I talked to you about this. Mm-hmm. I've been off it now for about 3 or 4 months, and I think I'm past the worst of it, but just this feeling.
Sometimes it can take up to 6 months until you feel what it's like to really be off it.
Oh, that's not good.
Yeah, I didn't know.
Because I was feeling just a horrible sense of doom. That's how I would put it. Like, like just get up and literally feel this physical weight.
Yeah.
But I've kind of gotten through that a lot. And what I wanted to relate back to, you know, not, you know, getting high right now is that I'm just kind of digging being, you know, off of everything and being in my life and feeling like this is good because, you know, I kind of live for being funny. I kind of live for, you know, making people laugh. And I just, since I have no kids, I kind of, my kids are my creations that I do, like my funny creations that I do. And I feel very...
I love that piece that you did on YouTube about you, the mountaineering guy, but you're just
You're
just climbing Griffith Park and
Runyon Canyon. Yeah.
And you've got like that oxygen tank on.
You know, and there's a great example of feeling good about things because that one best short in the Burbank Film Festival, and we're going, and me and Karen, who wrote it, my girlfriend Karen Simmons, we're going tonight to get an award, you know. But,
Where can people get a hold of you? Is it eddiepepitone.com?
Yes, eddiepepitone.com.
P-E-P-I-T-O-N-E?
Yeah, E-D-D-I-E-P-E-P-I-T-O-N-E.com.
Yeah. What are some recurring negative thoughts that you have towards yourself?
Oh, God. Recurring negative thoughts. I'm ugly. I am not... I'm not getting enough done. I'm a terrible planner. I'm gonna wind up homeless. I'm gonna wind up homeless. I'm gonna wind up penniless.
What are some before we go?
Not a good person.
Some slices of your life, some snapshots or little vignettes that were especially painful or embarrassing or life-changing?
For some reason, I always remember, you know, we talked about my mom not being there for me. I was a little kid, and I hit her on the head. I was real little. Mm-hmm. I must have been like, I mean, and this memory has always stuck with me. I don't have many memories mm-hmm. from when I was a little kid. I think I might have been 2 or 3, but I hit my mom on the head with a hammer.
Really?
Yeah, and I'll never forget the big, like, hubbub it created. I remember my mom screaming, he hit me on the head with the hammer, and my dad kind of, you know, holding me and going, you know, and bouncing me, going, all right, it's all right, because I was really freaked that I had did that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was like, whew, that was so emotionally charged. And then another.
See, I think you were telling your parents, I want to be a carpenter. They couldn't see that.
Read the Bible, I was saying to them. Read the Bible. Jesus was a carpenter. And then I'm trying to think of other, you know, it's usually just these traumatic fucking, I'll never forget being caught sexually exploring with my sister, like mm-hmm. my dad walking in, my younger.
Well, to be fair, you were in your 20s. What happened and how old were you?
I think I was like 7. No, I don't know. I don't know. Something like, yeah, about 7.
Yeah.
And I was just a kid being totally curious.
Normal. Totally normal.
Curious. My sister, we were taking baths together. But then, I don't know. I was like, oh, yeah, tell me, what's that right there? And my dad coming in and just being angry. And I just was so
shamed.
The shame things.
Yeah.
Like that. You know,
I'm sure it was done to
him. My shrink right now says I, you know, the panic attacks that I were diagnosed with are very similar to post-traumatic stress syndrome, like guys get it from war,
mm-hmm.
you know, stuff like that. Let's see. I would say life is a beautiful bloodbath.
Is that why you call your show Eddie Pepitone's Bloodbath?
Yeah, well, I call it bloodbath because I really do think life is an absolute bloodbath, a bloodbath of egos. It's a bloodbath of egos.
Yeah.
That's what I think. I mean, you know, it's so funny about meditation and serenity. You know, it's like I can meditate. And I do this joke on stage. I can meditate and I can feel, oh, that was good. You know, I feel good. I feel better. And then, you know, I'll go outside and one interaction with somebody who'll say, hey, you know, you're in the garage, you know, in the communal garage where we park our car. You know, excuse me, but you park your car a little close to mine. I'm immediately like, really? Because you've been doing that to me. That's how I see it.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a bloodbath of like,
yeah.
You know, everybody's got an agenda, uh-huh. you know? But.
So how do you interact with people? The question is, and.
Again, I think it comes down
de-escalate. To. De-escalate. Instead of escalating.
You know, I think, again, it comes down to what we talked about before, which is change it in me.
Yeah.
Like, if that person says that, like a healthy me mm-hmm. would have said, oh, I apologize. I'll really try to watch that.
Yeah.
You know? I always then fear that I'm getting taken advantage of.
And I think that's the misconception that makes our world a worse place, is we feel like we're weak or we're being taken advantage of, probably
yes.
about 90% too much of the time, instead of giving other people leeway and saying, you know what, this person's just, I hate to use the phrase because I don't know what other phrase to use, but this mm-hmm. person's just another sick child of God. And there are definitely times when you need to make a stand and you need to stick up for yourself or confront somebody. But I think those times are few and far between. And I think most of the time we need to let people be imperfect. Yeah. And the days when I'm able to do that and realize that they're not doing it at me.
Yes.
That's their coping mechanism because they're full of fear.
Right. Right. They don't even know me.
And when fear goes unchecked, it turns into anger. That's in my opinion.
Yeah.
And so what we feel is that person's anger a lot of times, and we think it's directed at us, but what they're just letting their fear the steam of their fear has built up into anger, and they're just trying to let it out. And so I try to let that go more than I used to, and I'm able to have good days when I can do that and not feel like I can't look like a punk here.
Right.
Doesn't make you a punk.
Right.
Doesn't make you a punk.
Right. Same here. I've had this thing lately also, I don't know, I think it's related, boundaries. Like I really, so that screws up my, because I've had trouble, or I do have trouble with boundaries.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Well, it sounds like your dad had no respect for your boundaries.
Yeah.
Wanted you to be his buddy, you know, was hypercritical of you and.
Yeah. Yeah. True.
I mean, it sounds like your family life wasn't a place where boundaries were.
So it's been really hard for me to like know what's appropriate.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, okay, you know, I have to, you know, without feeling like I'm hurting someone. Right.
Did you ever get the feeling that your dad was, that there was an authority from him that was safe and good? Or was it always like, I'm kind of on my own, my dad's kind of needy, sometimes I got to be the parent to him?
Yeah, more the latter. I never really felt that safety.
Yeah, that's a really common thing with comedians, and people in general on this, and myself included. It was the I remember being 6 or 7 and thinking to myself, I feel like I know people better than my parents do. I feel like I understand the dynamics of people. And I remember feeling almost...
When you were 6 or 7.
Almost feeling sorry and parental towards my parents, because see that they were fucked up in some level.
Yeah, me too.
You know, hey, that's why there's comedy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Can't wait to get on stage after this.
Well, buddy, thank you for coming and
thanks
and
for having
doing
me.
This. You're one of my favorite people to perform with. And if you've never seen Eddie, Pepitone, go check out his website. I'm sure you got a bunch of clips there. Watch some of the YouTube
Last fear I want to mention before we go off is that I wasn't good on the podcast today.
Yeah, that would be an irrational fear because you were great. And I have that fear whenever I go on anybody else's podcast. I am always convinced this was the worst episode ever of their podcast, and they're never going to have me on again. Every single time. Yeah. So I get that. But you would be wrong, my friend.
Thanks.
Love you, Eddie, and thank you. Thank you for coming and doing this.
Thanks, man.
All right.
This episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. Just imagine that you're at the vet and you get a bill, or they say, well, to do this operation on your dog, it's going to cost such and such, and you love your dog or your cat, and you don't have the money to pay it, and you have to make that very, very difficult decision. Well, the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/mental. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/mental. One more time, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/mental. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
You know, it's interesting that this episode with Eddie was taped a couple of days before I went home, and all the stuff that he talked about is stuff that actually came up for me at home. You know, talking about you got to let stuff, let people be how they are, and occasionally, yeah, you need to make a stand and you need to set boundaries. And for 48 years of my life, I kind of let my mom treat me the way she treats me because I want her to be happy. And it came to a head this last couple of days. I was staying with her for 4 days, which I didn't want to do, but I thought this will make her happy. She doesn't get to see enough of me. And I found myself one morning, I got up before she did, and I was walking past her bedroom, and the door was open, and I saw that she was in bed, and the thought occurred to me, it would be such a relief if she didn't wake up. And that's a horrible, horrible thing to think and to say, but that's the fucking truth. And I immediately felt guilty, and then I thought, what can I do so that I don't feel that way? What action can I take? What is the honest, loving thing for me to do to address this feeling? And she and I were talking later that day. And, you know, I hope she never listens to this podcast because I do love my mother and there's many things about her that are great. But she has this sick part of her. And we all have sick parts of us. But the sick part of her tries to love me, but it comes across as condescending and it puts me down. And it's a thousand different variations on you don't know, I know. And it kills any joy that I have going, and it makes me shut down, and it makes me want to leave. And later that day, we were having a conversation, and I could feel her trying to get closer to me. And it's interspersed with these put-downs of me, of telling me that I don't know. And I said, you know, Mom, I know that you want to be closer to me. And this is really hard for me to say because there's nobody that a child should feel closer to than their mother or their wife. But I don't feel safe around you. And that hurts me to say. It makes me sad because I know you want a better relationship with me. But these things that I ask you not to do, you continue to do. And I have to set up a boundary to protect myself. And it made me sad to have to do that. But I finally got to a point in my life where I am worth establishing that boundary. I feel I'm worth establishing that boundary and sticking to it. And so the ball is in her court. If she wants to begin to look at the way she treats her son and how it fills him with dread, it's up to her. I've done my part. I've swept up my part of the street and been honest. And that's all I can do. But it makes me sad that the one person who I should feel the most comforted and the safest by is the person I feel the least safe around in my life. And I think there's probably a lot of other people out there listening that have parents like that. And know that they're probably not doing it out of malice, but that doesn't mean you should subject yourself to it if it's making you miserable. And if you don't know how to set that boundary, get some professional help. It's taken me 20 years of professional help and support groups to get to the point where I could do that. But I feel free now that I've done it. And a little part of me really fucking hopes a large part of me hopes my mom never hears this. But if she does, I'm going to own it because that's how I feel. And if you feel like I do, hopefully you know now that you're not a bad person for thinking that or feeling that, and you're not alone. Thanks for listening.